Empty Tomb Accounts, the third talk in a series entitled Is the Bible Trustworthy? Responding to Bart Ehrman, was presented by Jack Crabtree on December 4, 2011 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2011. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. The handout and notes to which Dr. Crabtree refers in this talk is handout number 3 in this series.
So I'm going to continue on in our series responding to Bart Ehrman, the series on Is the Bible Trustworthy? I had a question last week, and I want to lead off with that, because it was a great question, and I should have answered it a lot earlier, but I didn't. So let me answer that first and get that out of the way first. The question was, am I rejecting the grammatical, historical approach to the study of the Bible? And the answer is no, and let me explain. Ehrman's position in this book is that he's advocating what he calls the historical critical method, not the grammatical historical method. Don't get those confused. I am a proponent of the grammatical historical approach to studying the Bible, that we look at the grammar of the language in its historical context. We want to know what the author meant when he wrote that book in the time and place and history in which he wrote it to the people that he wrote it to. If that's the grammatical historical approach, I'm all for that. That's hopefully what we've been doing for decades here at Reformation Fellowship. So I'm not rejecting that at all. And arguably, in a kind of way, the historical critical approach would probably include an acceptance of the grammatical historical approach, but it goes way beyond that. And I want to take a little bit of time to explain where that language, the historical critical approach, comes from so that you have a better orientation to what it is Ehrman is saying. The historical critical approach includes what's called biblical criticism. It started way back in the 18th century when people began to notice, a guy named Tischendorf began to collect a bunch of manuscripts of the New Testament, whole manuscripts, fragments of manuscripts, and over the years, more and more and more, different papyri and codices and various copies of, there's all these thousands of manuscripts, and although the match between the manuscripts is incredibly high, and I can't emphasize how incredibly high it is, nonetheless, you do find differences occasionally in some passages about how this manuscript reads versus how this manuscript reads. So it leaves open the question, what did the original manuscript say? How did it read? We know how the copies read, but how did the original manuscript read? And they developed a science called textual criticism, where they tried to develop some principles and procedures and some rules about how you would reconstruct what the original text, how the original text must have read, given that we have these manuscripts. That's a relatively innocuous academic exercise. It's an important one. I try to engage in it every time that I go to a text. The important question to me is, which text am I interpreting? And so I want to see, do the best I can to reconstruct what I think is the original text before I even start exegesis. So, but that got the name textual criticism. The next move in academic study of the New Testament was what's called source criticism. And that arose in the context of studying the gospel accounts, and most of my remarks are going to be confined to the gospel accounts here. As they were studying the gospel accounts, they noticed that Matthew, Mark, and Luke, what they labeled the synoptic gospels, copy each other, match each other very, very closely. And so they started asking the question, was Mark written first and Matthew just copied large portions of Matthew and Luke copied portions of Mark? Did I say Matthew? That Matthew copied Mark and Luke copied Mark? And they just tried to sort out who wrote first, and to what extent did he did that author provide a source for the other writers? Again, that's relatively innocuous. I don't have any difficulty with source criticism. There are some crazy things that get said by people in the context of source criticism, but the basic question and the way that you approach it is perfectly valid. I don't know if I have an answer to the question they're asking. It doesn't make a huge difference to me, but it's certainly a legitimate question. So that's innocent enough. Where the devil enters in is in form criticism, which was the next step. Form criticism is asking the question, so Mark has this gospel that he wrote, but this gospel that Mark wrote is really basically, it's like a pearl necklace. Each, it has these little units of stories that are kind of all strung together. And those little units of stories, the form critic calls a pericope. So it's got a whole handful of pericope that have been strung together in this gospel account. He gives this story, and then he ends that story and gives the next story, ends that story, gives the next story, ends that story, and gives the next story. And the stories, the pericope, seem to be fairly self-contained little units. Well, where did that come from? Where did the little pericope themselves come from? And the story the form critic tells is that Jesus was on the earth, and he taught some stuff. And in the course of telling some stuff, he had some really good sound bites that he told along the way. And out of the various things that he taught, out of the various things that he said, there were these memorable little statements that became the irritant sand out of which the pearl is formed, you know, the basic core, the basic origin of the pearl, was something that Jesus said or did. But taking from the tradition of what it is that Jesus said and did, along came a generation of storytellers. They're teachers and preachers in the church who taught and preached by telling stories. And one generation might be kind of fond of telling parables. The next generation might be fond of telling stories where Jesus makes this wise saying. Another generation might favor stories of Jesus appearing to people. And they catalog the different kinds of pericope, the different kinds of stories that get told, and they decide that each of those different kinds of stories arose in a different generation of believers. Now, by generation, you know, I'm using that loosely. It could be a different decade. It could be a different, depends on how quickly the fads swept through Palestine. But over the course of time, layer after layer after layer, different anonymous Bible teachers added their mark to the creation of this tradition as they took what had been given to them and reshaped it and remolded it and retold it and so on and so forth. Notice it in this story. Nobody is seeking to preserve what actually got said and what actually happened. That's not the purpose of the stories being told. The purpose of the stories being told are to teach people in their generation something about how they should live their life as believers and as Christians. The authority, if it has any authority, the authority behind what they're saying only goes so far as their own wisdom. And some would argue only reaches so far as the Spirit of God is working in them to give them the wisdom to tell a story that's going to help the church, the community of believers, deal with their issues and their problems. Okay, form criticism then is working like an archaeologist to try to match the issues being addressed by various pericopes with the form that the pericope comes in. Is it a parable? Is it a wisdom saying? Is it a this? Is it a that? Or is this other thing? They ideally, if the form critical story is right, ideally you could become a word archaeologist and dig down through the layers and be able to identify at what stage of the development of the church, the Christian community, and the tradition did this story take the form that it's in right now? Well, that was the beginning of what I called last week the academic fiction that people escape to in the academic study of the New Testament. There is no evidence for the story. There is no reason to believe that story. It's a myth. It's a myth that got told about the development of the New Testament, and it has stuck in academia. So when you read it, when you hear scholars speaking on the Discovery Channel or the History Channel or CBS or ABC telling you what scholars have found and what they have discovered and so on, they have started from the myth of form criticism. They haven't established it. They just start there a priori, and then they draw their conclusions and do their research and do their work from there. That's what Ehrman means by the historical critical approach. After form criticism came a bunch of other criticisms. Redaction criticism came next. And then every few years, somebody invents a new kind of criticism that they add to the mix. From form criticism on, they, I would argue, are no longer innocent. They are no longer valid. They are no longer legitimate. They are just making stuff up. Academic fictions, myths that have been created by the academic class to define their turf on the one hand and not deal with the scripture in the kind of straightforward way that we are attempting to do when we take the Bible as the Word of God. Okay, any questions on that?
It's just kind of a brief comment. What you're describing is like what I've read about other religions and so on. And there's kind of this pan thinking that it's all just myths. Mm-hmm. And so I think some scholars are like, okay, we're putting Christianity on an equal plane with all the others.
Right. Yeah, and it's very understandable, right? I mean, these are all religions, and so we all look at them as historians and sociologists and social psychologists in exactly the same way. Don't they play the same role and so on? So what's significantly different about what most of you and I believe is that Christianity is not just one more religion.
Oh, yes.
It's not an artifact. It's not made up by human beings. It's what has happened when Jesus sent his son into the world and collided with our reality. And what happened is we had to come to terms with that fact and that reality and that truth. And our faith stems from that collision that we had with the fact of Jesus' messiahship. So our a priori assumption is that this needs to be taken seriously because I have to figure out who this Jesus is. And we could make a case, as I'm attempting to do here, for the reliability and the integrity of the text, but I'm prepared to believe that Christianity is just an invented religion by human beings. But someone needs to prove that to me. We don't just assert it a priori and believe it and go from there. Somebody's going to need to show that to me because my own personal experience, my own personal conviction that there's something else going on here. This is for real.
Yes. Second point I was going to bring out is that from reading about all these religions, I see a lot of dishonesty in that they're not looking at the real basic tenets. Like, for instance, in Christianity, there's some very, how can you say, strong statements that need to be looked at. And like, Jesus, statements like, I am God, so on. These are very strong statements that you've got to look at. I think if you're going to be honest intellectually, it's like, okay, is what's being told the truth or is it a lie?
Right.
And I don't see that in academia. It's just, you know, this is just another religion. And I think that's part of the blindness with other religions and looking at them and seeing that there are definite problems that can relate to us that they're completely glossing over because they're not being honest.
Right. Nothing wrong with asking the question. It's a perfectly legitimate question, but as you point out, the dishonesty, I think, in academia is they're not really willing to accept the answer that this is the truth.
Right.
That's my contention.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to bring forward.
Yeah. What happens when a Christian scholar like you of integrity were to look at the Hindu or Islamic writings, the Quran? You know, how would that come out then if you looked at them with the same eye that you're looking at the Christian scriptures?
Well, I've never done that, so I can't speak from experience. I would like to think, I would hope that I could look at those texts charitably with the same kind of charity that I think one should look at the biblical texts. And I suspect that what I'm going to find is a variety of different things, but in the end, I don't think I'm going to find them ultimately compelling to me.
Yeah, I mean, just wondering, you know, we as Christians then tend to look at them with our preconceived assumptions that they're not true, you know, rather than looking at them like you're saying we should look at the Christian text.
So yeah, and that's a great point. You know,
academically, if one could prove that they're not true, you know.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
If academically one could prove that they're not true in the same way that you're trying to prove in a way that Christianity is.
I suspect that there'd be a certain difficulty in doing that because something like I have read a little bit in the Quran, and there's a lot in the Quran that's perfectly true. Mm-hmm. I mean, just the one God who exists, you should worship him and submit to him and submit to his will. Is that wrong? I don't think so. I mean, I think that's exactly right. Where you get in trouble in Islam, like most religions, is not particularly and necessarily in their scriptures, but where they go from there with their scriptures. So I would like to think, and I think it's a good warning to us, that we as Christians, instead of, even though it's logically valid, that if Christianity is true, then Hinduism is probably false. If Christianity is not probably false. If what kind of logic was that? It's logically valid. If Christianity is true, Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam are false. But when I go to their scriptures, I shouldn't decide because those religions are false, their scriptures are made up, an artifact, an invented religion. I should approach them with the same charity that I would want anyone else to approach the Bible with. Now, what I think you would find is either it lacks, although true, it lacks substance. It doesn't really get to the heart of the human problem. It really doesn't get to the heart of the human solution. It really is sort of eccentric. It's kind of off-center about what mankind really needs and so on. Or you might be able to see real failings of the text, real genuine contradictions and so on. I don't know. I don't know if you would find that. Okay, let's move on. Last week we looked at Peter's denials, just briefly to talk about what we looked at last week. My contention is that they would be perfectly compatible accounts with each other if we recognize three things. We recognize that, in fact, the three denials of Jesus were very complex occasions of Peter denying Jesus repeatedly. So the one occasion of him denying may involve a back and forth between Peter and one person, Peter and several people. We just don't know the details of the account, but somebody saying, you were with them. Peter saying, no, I wasn't. Yes, you were. No, I wasn't. I saw you. No, you didn't. I mean, we don't know, but it could have been a complex interaction with a number of people attacking him and Peter rejecting their accusations. If we recognize that that's the case, then that's going to play a role in our reconciling them. Second thing we would recognize is that the statements of accusation are not verbatim, and Peter's denials are not verbatim. They can't be verbatim. They weren't speaking English. They weren't even speaking Greek. So what we're reading in our Bibles is not what they said. It's a rendering of what was said. It was capturing the gist of it. It was capturing the essence of it. It was capturing the, and perhaps even the spirit of it. But it wasn't a verbatim quote. So if you and I were to bear witness and we were paying very close attention to the words that somebody used, and then we gave an account of it in Greek, not in English, and we gave an account of it in Greek, would your Greek read the same as my Greek? Not likely, right? Because any act of interpretation, any act of translation, I should say, is an act of an interpretation where you understand it first and then render it the way you render it. And you are going to be part of why it gets rendered the way it gets rendered. Your style, your language, your vocabulary, all that's going to play into how you rendered it. Well, we don't expect the accounts to be exactly verbatim matching because they're not even recording it in the language in which the statements were spoken. And then finally, if we recognize that Mark in particular is giving a detailed account of Peter's denials, whereas Matthew, Luke, and John are, well, John has a detailed account in his own way, but Matthew and Mark are simply giving the episodes, giving an account of the fact that these things happened, but they're not supplying us with a whole lot of detail, and they're not interested in doing that. The main objection that somebody could raise to my talking about Peter's denials is that, well, if you're right, if I'm right, Jack, then the Gospel of John is misleading. And I want to talk about that for a second because that's going to be important throughout our whole discussion here. The reason it would be misleading is because in John's account, if you remember how I gave it, John is only dealing with two denials. Once, early around the fire in the courtyard, and then significant time lapse, at least an hour, but maybe even 2 hours, time lapse, and then he's around the fire again, and then John records two different statements of accusation toward Peter, and Peter denying them each time. Well, someone might very well look at it and say, well, count the number of times in John's account that he's accused of being with Jesus. Three, Jack, count them, three. There's three statements of accusation. And how many times does Jesus state that it's not true? I'm sorry, not Jesus. Peter state that it's not true? Three, Jack, count them. So given that Jesus predicted that he would deny him three times, clearly John thinks, the objection goes, clearly John thinks that he has given you the three times that Jesus had predicted. But I have reconstructed the account suggesting we only have two times being recorded that Peter denied Jesus. And my argument for that was John appears to be giving us an eyewitness account. And as the story goes, John and Peter together around the fire the first time Peter denies him. Peter splits and leaves for the shadows and under the porches near the gate and denies him a second time, John isn't there. John's still back at the fire. Then Peter returns to the fire, and the third denial happens with John standing right there watching. So John has recorded what he has seen. Now, one of the arguments I would make defending that that's what happened, John is the only gospel that doesn't say, and the cock crowed, and Peter remembered the words that Jesus said and went out. I don't remember if he talks about him weeping, but it doesn't talk about him. No, it doesn't. It doesn't. John doesn't draw attention to the fact that Peter's denials were a fulfillment of the prediction. My contention would be, why doesn't he draw attention to the fact that the denials he listed are a fulfillment of the prediction? Because he can't know whether it is or not. From an eyewitness standpoint, the standpoint from which he's writing, he only counts two denials. What Peter did out in the porches, he knows nothing about. So rather than confusingly draw attention to this being the fulfillment of the prediction that he would deny him three times, he just leaves that alone. Doesn't even go there. Doesn't even talk about it. Earlier in the gospel, he had included the fact that Jesus predicted that. So it would make all the sense in the world that he would want to draw attention to that fact, but he doesn't. And it's striking that he doesn't because he had recorded the prediction. I think he doesn't precisely because it's not obvious from his account in his mind that the prediction has been fulfilled because he's only given you two occasions. So to talk about John's account being misleading is only true if I make three assumptions. I assume that John is giving me the whole story. I assume that John is intending to explain the fulfillment of Jesus' prediction. And I assume that John's purpose is to recreate the real drama that exists in each occasion of his denial and to accurately capture the flavor and intensity of each of those denials on each of those occasions. Well, let me critique each of those. John's giving me the whole story. That will never be and can never be true of any historical account. No historical account will ever give you the whole story. Every historian has to be selective in the details he gives you. John in particular seems to be intent, as I said, on only giving you what he knows directly as an eyewitness or otherwise, but has some kind of direct knowledge of. What about the assumption that John is intending to explain the fulfillment of Jesus' prediction? I've already commented on that. I don't think that's the case, and I think we have evidence in the text that that was not his intention to do that. And thirdly, I assume that John's purpose is to recreate the drama of each occasion of denial and to accurately capture the flavor and intensity of it. All we have to do is pay close attention to the text, and it becomes obvious that that's not his purpose. Anytime you can go, and they accused him of such and such. Well, how did they accuse him? As I mentioned last week, it wasn't in some sort of vocal chorus where in unison they said, you were with him altogether now, you were with him. It was obviously a give and take, a complex event where several people were attacking him. So every one of those assumptions is wrong. But this gets to the heart of all of these, all of our attempts to reconcile the gospel accounts. It's always going to be the case that once we get the account reconstructed, there may be one or more of the gospels that might strike us as, well, this is misleading then. If what happened is what you're saying happened, this gospel account has misled me. The gospel account has misled you? Or your prior assumptions about what you expect that gospel account to be giving you. You come at it with certain assumptions about the structure, the logic, the purpose, the agenda, the style. All those things are informing your expectations about what John is supposed to be doing or what Matthew is supposed to be doing. And it may very well be that if you have false assumptions about the intrinsic nature of the account, then your false assumptions about the intrinsic nature of the account are going to mislead you with respect to what the event was. Because you can't understand the event that an author is describing if you've misunderstood the way he is describing it to you and the logic and structure of the account and description that he's giving you. So we'll see that more clearly when we get to the accounts of the resurrection, which I will do now. Okay. So I've given you this handout, and hopefully you will, if you have not already, digest that. And I don't want to cover all the details of everything in there, but let me just basically give you an overview of my reconstruction of what happened, and then we'll go from there. One of the first and most confusing things for people is we have a whole centuries-long tradition that Jesus was crucified on Friday, we all rested on Saturday, and he raised from the dead on Sunday. I mean, that's just Good Friday, Sunday, Easter is just so fixed and burned in our brain that we have no other way of thinking about it. But in fact, that's impossible given the historical accounts that we have in the gospel. Jesus died on Wednesday. The Passover was Wednesday. He was crucified on the Passover. the Sabbath that is often spoken of in these gospel accounts is Thursday. Now, why would the Sabbath be on Thursday? Because what I didn't realize for decades as a Bible teacher, not having ever really paid any attention to it, and being a 21st century American Gentile instead of a first century Jew, is that the weekly Sabbath is not the only Sabbaths that Jews keep. They keep the weekly Sabbath every week, but there are specified Sabbaths that pertain to all the various festivals that the Jews have. And one that is most noteworthy is the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread happen, they're juxtaposed with each other. Passover happens on the first day of the festival, and then begins the seven-day festival of unleavened bread. Go right back to Exodus. I think it's Exodus. If you go right back to Exodus, what happens on the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread? You have a holy Sabbath unto the Lord. So the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread is a Sabbath, and the last day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread is a Sabbath. So you're going to have another Sabbath in the middle of the next week. Right in the middle of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, then, comes the weekly Sabbath if your Passover was on Wednesday. If your Passover was on Wednesday, you're going to have a Thursday Sabbath. Friday, you get some rest from resting, and then Saturday, you have to rest all over again. And that now is your weekly Sabbath. That gives time for everything that the gospel accounts tell you occurred to occur. Otherwise, it's impossible for everything that the gospel writers tell us occurred, it's impossible to fit it in. It couldn't possibly have happened between the beginning of Sabbath on Friday evening and Saturday morning, the end of Sabbath Saturday morning. So what happened? Jesus is crucified. He's crucified in the throughout the day, and it's getting close to the Sabbath day, the first day of unleavened bread, Thursday, as the sun begins to dawn. Nicodemus, who had been a member of the Sanhedrin, a wealthy, landed elder, was a member of the Sanhedrin, and he decided, and he was a more or less secret follower of Jesus up until this time. He'd become persuaded that Jesus really was the beginning of the kingdom of God. So when Jesus is crucified, he takes it upon himself to go public and risks a great deal, I'm sure, to ask permission to take Jesus' body and bury it. So he goes to the Roman centurion or whatever who says, well, you need to ask Pilate. No, I'm sorry. He goes to Pilate to ask permission. The Pilate says, is he dead yet? And goes to the Romans and finds out that Jesus is dead. And so grants permission for Nicodemus to take the body and bury it. I'm sorry, Nicodemus, Joseph. Somewhere along the line, another man who's a secret follower of Jesus on the Sanhedrin, a Pharisee, a rabbi named Nicodemus, joins forces with Joseph. It's not clear at what point in the process, but he decides he's going to help Joseph. So Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus together take the body, take spices, 100 pounds of spices, wrap the body appropriately in the clothing with the spices. And Joseph of Arimathea has a tomb that has been dug for his family in a garden not too far from the place of the crucifixion. So he decides that he's going to bury Jesus' body in his own tomb. So he takes the body, buries it in the tomb. As that's happening, so this is before sundown on Wednesday night. There are various women. We know two of them by name, Mary Magdalene and the one called the other Mary, and possibly Salome, that are mentioned by name. We don't know how many other women might have been with them and just go unmentioned in the accounts. But anyway, a number of Jesus' women followers from Galilee are anxious to see Jesus buried properly and from a distance are just watching enough to know where the body goes. They want to know where the body goes. It would appear that they probably, it's not clear to them whether he's been properly buried. I mean, I assume that they think he has not been properly buried, because they're going to come back in a few days to bury him properly. And why would they want to do that if he's already been properly buried? So they must not be able to tell whether he's received a proper burial. So they're observing, where is this, where is the body of our master? Then at sunset, you're a Jew, you can't do nothing now. You've got to wait a day. You've got to rest. So all day Thursday, only one thing happens on Thursday, and that is the chief priests and the powers that be go to Pilate, and they say, you know, he did say he was going to raise from the dead, and we're really afraid the disciples will come and steal his body and then claim that he raised from the dead, and then we'll really be in trouble. So would you post a guard at the tomb and make sure that this body doesn't get stolen? And Pilate says, you got guards, have at it. So they post guards to make sure that that Jesus' body is not stolen, and they seal the tomb. They place some kind of wax seal or something around the stone that has been rolled in front, which was standard practice, by the way. It's not just unique to Jesus. You dig a hole in the rock, and you have a big round stone that you close it up with. That's just what they did. But they sealed it. That's unusual. They sealed it to make sure that it's on pain of death will you break that seal, I think, is the idea. So that happens on Thursday. Now we get to Friday. On Friday, we're the Sabbath is over. The women go buy the spices, prepare all the spices, buy the cloth, all the stuff that they need to get ready to go and bury Jesus. But apparently, that was a day-long process to get prepared to do that. You come to the end of Friday, and they haven't done anything except prepare themselves. Now comes the weekly Sabbath. They can't do nothing. They just have to rest. And then at the end of the Sabbath, they're very anxious to get on with the process of burying him. So early, at the very earliest time possible, they come on Sunday morning as the sun is dawning. Now, if you read the accounts carefully, they're worded differently. And it's critical to see that, because some of the women are coming to look at the tomb. Other women are coming bringing spices and perfumes to prepare the body. Those are two different groups of women, I would argue. John mentions that when Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea wrapped the body, it was 100 pounds of spices. That's a fairly cumbersome bag of stuff that you're going to have to convey. So my speculation would be the first group of women, which included Mary Magdalene, the other Mary, and Salome, that those three women, perhaps others with them, are going on ahead to the tomb to problem solve. We've got this problem. There's a big stone in front of it and a guard posted. How are we going to get access to the body? They need to get to work on the problem solving of figuring out how to get access to the body. So they're going on ahead while the other women are coming along bearing the supplies and spices and whatever else. So the biggest tension in the accounts rests in the fact that one group of women seems to have a very different experience from the second group of women. Well, why do they? Because they're different experiences. They're moments apart, you know, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 20 minutes apart. We don't know what kind of time span, but the first group of women have probably already left and are on their way back to tell the disciples what they've seen before the second group of women even arrive at the tomb. So one group is met by one angel. The other group is met by two young men, and I would argue they're angels, but by two angels. They don't have exactly the same conversation. The angels don't say exactly the same thing. They seem to be significantly different events, the two events. But the reason they seem to be two events is because they are two events. It's not two different descriptions of the same event. They're two disparate events. So Mary Magdalene, the other Mary, Salome, go off to tell the disciples. A few minutes later, the other women come along. they don't encounter anybody before they go into the tomb. When they go into the tomb, they see the two angels. I think I'm remembering my details right. They see the two angels, they talk to them, and they too go to run to tell the disciples. They arrive at different, probably one after the other. The first group of women is probably undoubtedly already telling their story. Then come these other women and tell a different story, right? They don't tell exactly the same story, which I think contributes to the confusion of the whole thing. And remember, at least one of the gospel writers, maybe both of them, describe them as their story being dismissed. They just seem like hysterical women. This is not real. Well, I think what contributes to the perception that these are just hysterical women is they can't get their story straight. Why can't they get their story straight? Because they're different stories. And I think that probably contributes to the confusion. But out of that confusion, Mary Magdalene in particular seems to be able to convince Peter and John, come and take a look for yourself. So Peter and John run to the tomb. It doesn't say so, but what makes the most sense is Mary Magdalene comes along with them or perhaps shortly after them, because one of the accounts does say they ran to the tomb. So she may not have kept pace with them, so she's coming along after them. Peter and John go to the tomb. John sees that the stone is rolled away. Peter actually charges into the tomb, sees that the tomb is empty. John joins him and sees that it's empty, and they go away. They go home. Probably they're on their way home when Mary Magdalene arrives. Mary Magdalene goes into the tomb. Notice that John and Peter didn't encounter any angels. But Mary Magdalene goes into the tomb, and once again, I think it's two again, is it? Can't remember, but one or two this time, encounter some angels and she begins to talk to them. Then she steps outside the tomb and sees who she thinks is the gardener and says, tell me where you've laid him, just so that I might, what does she say, bury him? But just, would you just please tell me where you buried him? And Jesus speaks, and Mary recognizes that it's Jesus. Now, in the meantime, it would appear that Mary Magdalene is a very prominent woman in this group. She always gets mentioned. And I mean, in any list of names where there's a group of women, Mary Magdalene seems to be very prominent. She has gone back to the tomb, whether with her or shortly after her, following her. Several of the other women have come as well. So Mary Magdalene grabs on to Jesus in some way, and apparently coming along behind her, the other women do as well. And I think they're separated in time, frankly. I mean, I think Mary Magdalene has had her encounter with Jesus, and then the women come running up or walking up, and they too grab him because he says something slightly different to them. But these women then have their encounter with Jesus. If I'm right, notice that it was the women who were the first eyewitnesses to the risen Christ. Not John, not Peter, not the apostles, not the disciples. It was his women disciples from Galilee who are given the privilege of having the first visual encounter with the risen Christ. Then they run back again to the upper room, perhaps, where the disciples are gathered to report that this time they report, we have seen Jesus. Not just we saw an empty tomb and some angels talking to us, we have seen Jesus. Well, that's, I think, what happened. The two keys for understanding how these accounts can be reconciled is to realize that Luke records a different event from Matthew and Mark, a different group of women who had a different experience, and that John's account of Mary Magdalene's visit is not her first trip to the tomb, but her second trip to the tomb. Once you recognize those two things, that the accounts are perfectly compatible with each other, and there's no real tension or contradiction. Okay. There are several objections that could be raised about Matthew's account is inconsistent with how I have my version and how I've reconstructed it. I think I will leave that for you to digest just for the sake of time. And if some of you have, let me open it up for any questions you have at this point about how the accounts are reconcilable.
Does Josephus give any help in understanding any of this? Or is,
not in these particular accounts, no.
Okay.
Jack, you reported that Mary Magdalene, Mary the other Mary, which is Christ's mother?
I didn't say that. I think that's probably true.
And
Salome. But most people, most of your resources don't attribute the other Mary, don't identify the other Mary as Jesus' mother. But it sure looks like it to me.
And Salome went to the tomb because they wanted to be sure that the proper burial of with oils, etc., had been carried out correctly?
I believe so, yes.
And it's pretty routine that a stone is rolled in front of a tomb?
Right.
Then how would you expect that these three women would roll a stone?
That's what they were worried about.
It's their intention to do that.
Yeah, that's what they were worried about, I think, is how are we going to do this? I think they're hoping they can ask the guards for help.
It's just an unexplainable.
Yeah, we just don't have that detail. I mean, it's not unthinkable that they could actually ask the guards to be merciful and allow them in to take care of the body, in which case the guards would do that. But I think that's what they realize. We got a problem here, and we need to figure out some way to gain access to it.
One other identity question. Salome, is that a cousin of Jesus? Is that John the Baptist's sister?
This is a foggy memory. I believe it's John and James' mother, the mother of John, the gospel writer, and James, his brother. Is that what I mean? Yeah.
I thought she was I'm drawing from a historic narrative, and it seemed to me that Salome was a childhood contemporary of Jesus.
Of Jesus.
Yeah, and I'm just trying. I'm asking for clarification. I don't know. I'm not trying.
Yeah,
I'm
going by memory, and I wouldn't trust that. But I think her children are John and James, the apostles, and disciples.
Are there other scholars that believe it's two separate accounts or two separate groupings of women?
I just don't know. I've never encountered any. One that reconstructs it in this way, but that doesn't mean they haven't. I just am not aware of it.
So do you know how they reconcile it in their own mind? I mean, that, you know, a biblical teacher who wants to believe that the stories are consistent?
Yeah, you'd think I would have looked at that. I'm sorry. It's been so long since I've read somebody else's reconciliation. I just don't remember.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm just wondering about the timing again. I guess I assumed or understood that the Last Supper, the time in the upper room, was the Passover.
I think it was, yeah.
But then he was crucified the following day, was it? You say,
well,
how
but,
did that...
but remember in Judaism, the day starts at
right,
sundown
okay.
and goes till the next sundown.
Okay, so...
So they have their dinner at the first part of the day.
So that would have been on Tuesday then?
On
if he was crucified Wednesday...
Well, what we would call
for
Tuesday.
Us, yeah, that's what
exactly.
As far as days of the week. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Old Testament prophesy, and even Jesus, often you hear that as Jonah spent 3 days in the belly of the whale, and there's references in prophecy to 3 days and three nights, it seems, I mean, this would at least kind of stretch that out, because if he was crucified on Friday and rose on Sunday, that's only two nights.
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, Jesus is very explicit that he will be 3 days and three nights,
I think.
I've never been satisfied with, well, count Friday as one, Saturday as one, and Sunday, the few moments on Sunday as one. There you got your 3 days. But that doesn't seem to be the spirit of what Jesus is predicting. That he says he's going to be 3 days and three nights in the belly of the earth, isn't that how he puts it?
Yeah.
There's no way he's 3 days and three nights in the belly of the earth if he's crucified, if he's buried late on Friday and is raised early on Sunday. So, yeah, that's another problem with the traditional view, I think.
I just had a question about the guards.
Yeah.
they were Roman guards, right?
It's not obvious that they were. They may have been, because what, if I'm remembering correctly, Pilate doesn't offer him Roman guards. They say, you have your own guards, you do it. And, but he gives them permission to do it, but he's basically saying it's on you. So remember that the same people that arrested him in the garden, those are not Romans. Those are the military that have been assigned to, it's called the Temple Guard. And they are men who've been, are under the jurisdiction of the chief priests and the Sanhedrin. So they take their orders from the Jews, not the Romans. Some of them could have been mercenaries. I mean, I don't know where they came from, but I don't even know. I can't rule out the fact that there could be Roman soldiers who have been put on assignment to serve in the Temple Guard. I don't know, but they're not under the jurisdiction of Rome at this point. They're under the jurisdiction because they don't go back and report what happened with the empty tomb. They don't report that to Pilate. They report it to the chief priests and the Sanhedrin. Oh, I missed that part, didn't I? The guards go back. Is it Matthew who tells us? The guards go back while all this stuff is happening. It's basically concurrent with the women visiting the empty tomb. They're headed back to find the chief priests in the Sanhedrin, and they report the angel coming down and the earthquake and the, you know, all that happened that surrounding the resurrection. They report that and say, what are we supposed to do? You didn't want anybody to steal the body, but like, you didn't give us the weapons to fight that. So what are we going to do? And they concoct this story that the disciples came and stole the body. And is it Matthew or John? But anyway, that they had comments that
Matthew.
Okay, that has been that's still abroad. The story that's still being told.
I probably didn't hear you correctly. It sounded like, I'm still trying to make 3 days and three nights.
Okay.
If there's a non-Sabbath day between two Sabbath days, mm-hmm. then that would be 4 days to Sunday.
Well, but see, he's not, it's really basically he's in the belly of the earth Thursday, Friday, Saturday. He's not buried until sundown on Wednesday. So the rest of Wednesday night and Thursday night and Friday night and Saturday, and then he's up. So 3 days, three nights. It's actually three nights, 3 days.
So he rose on a Saturday?
Could be. Yeah, we don't really actually know when he rose. Okay. See, that if you read Matthew's account in the wrong way, with your wrong expectations, that is, if you're expecting it to be strictly chronological, then you could get the impression that it was early Sunday morning that the earthquake happened, et cetera, et cetera. But we don't know, I would argue, we don't know when that event happened. It could very well have been during the night.
Well, it would have had to have been Saturday in order to be 3 days.
Right.
Okay. So a whole day has passed before the women come.
Well, no.
Because it says that's the first day of the week. In Matthew 28, after the Sabbath, as it began to dawn toward the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary came to look at the grave.
That's early Sunday morning.
Right.
Okay. So it could have been just an hour before that he was raised from the dead, an hour before that.
I'm sorry, I'm still having trouble with the math. Okay. If he died on Wednesday,
okay,
then he was buried Wednesday.
All of Wednesday night in the grave,
right?
All of Thursday,
okay.
All of Thursday night in the grave, all of Friday.
Friday, okay.
All of Friday night in the grave, all of Saturday, and he's raised.
Okay, like Saturday night before whatever. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Do we have any evidence that the women knew that guards had been posted?
No, but I'm just assuming that since they were observing Joseph and since they know, well, yeah, I don't know, because it's not till the next day but they know where it is. So
right, and having seen what seems to be the most likely place of the grave, the opening is small. There is a trough that a flat disc-like rock rolled in. I think before I saw it, I sort of imagined it was a big round boulder mm-hmm. kind of thing, but something in a trough that would guide
looks like
it.
A big wheel.
Yeah, a big wheel. Unless they had a rock that was way bigger than you needed to close that opening, I'm thinking for three women could roll it, especially if they had a little engineering under their belt and they pushed it and propped it and pushed it and propped yeah. it and pushed it. You know, it wouldn't be not doable.
Yeah, it wouldn't be impossible.
But mm-hmm. I think that makes some sense to go, that they would have to go and reconnoiter and figure out, okay, how exactly are we going to do this? While these other women are lugging these 100 pounds of spices and everything, we're going to try to get this done as quickly as possible. Because I'm guessing even if they didn't know that a guard had been posted, they would probably recognize that people doing things to Jesus' body, providing honor or whatever, would not go over well certain quarters. Mm-hmm. So we want to get it done early. We want to get it done and get out of there. And hopefully nobody will be the wiser, because there are probably repercussions.
And you're right. I have falsely assumed that they knew that the guard was there. They may not have known. You're right. If they had not been back a second time to observe it, they wouldn't have necessarily known.
And I don't know how far this would be from where they were to the garden, if it would be farther they could walk in the Sabbath.
Right, right.
So,
you may have said this. Was it customary Jewish or cultural practice for the women to be the tenders of the dead people?
I don't know. I've always assumed so, but I don't actually know that.
Okay, and then the other thing is, do we have other examples of women who were around Jesus spreading the message of Jesus other than this one? I'm trying to get a sense of, step into the context a little bit more, of how unusual or atypical is it, or like.
Do you mean like a prophetic role or a teaching role, or is that
teaching, spreading the news? I guess of Jesus is here. Jesus is doing. Jesus is performing miracles, or I guess a significant contributors to spreading what they knew about him while he was still alive.
I'm not aware of any explicit evidence where a woman is named by name as playing that role, but mm-hmm. I don't think there's any way to understand the gospel accounts without implicitly assuming that by word of mouth these women were spreading the word and bringing others to hear him and that kind of stuff. Because there's a significant, when you get all the names, we know from Luke that one of the women that came to Jerusalem was Joanna. We know from earlier in the Luke account, Joanna is the wife of Chuza, the steward of Herod, the king of Galilee. So she's a wealthy woman, very wealthy woman, upper crust, but she is a disciple of Jesus. And Luke tells us it was from women like her, of their means, that the disciples of Jesus, that's what sustained them. They didn't have to work, because women of means were supporting them from their means. Well, she was a wealthy woman. Well, she is one of them that is mentioned reporting back to about the empty tomb to the disciples. And there another one that doesn't show up in these accounts but shows up earlier is Susanna. We don't know anything about her. But there are a number of them that are named by name that they just show up, but we don't really know anything about them. But they're significant enough in the community that the gospel writer names them. So he's expecting his readers that to mean something to his readers, I think.
And so is your sense that, aside from some of the disciples thinking that these women are hysterical, do you have a sense of whether the women going to the, you know, the disciples and bringing such intense big news. Was that met with opposition?
Yes. In fact, the account tells us so. And they did not believe them, it says.
They didn't believe them, right, because they were saying strange things. But did it have to, was it a part of offensive to the Jewish culture as well?
I would think so.
But they were, okay.
Yeah, Jesus' way of interacting with women was culture busting. It was very unusual. In the Talmud, I think it is, that, you know, the Mosaic Covenant says that you shall not convict someone except by the testimony of two or three witnesses. Can't be a woman. No woman can be included in that witness. So there's a cultural prejudice against the credibility, integrity perhaps, of women, such that I think them reporting about what happened at the empty tomb would have been met with a great deal of suspicion. These are just women. This doesn't count. So that's one of the reasons it's pretty significant, don't you think? So who does he appear to first? The women. I mean, he's honoring women in a way that their culture never really had. And Jewish culture was better than most with respect to women. You get plenty of testimony that a rabbi is praised in the Talmud that he had X number of sons and he taught them all Torah, and then another rabbi is praised because he had seven daughters and he taught all of them Torah. So the fact that you would teach your daughters, make them literate, and make them students of Torah was seen as a wonderful thing to do. And yet, even at that, even with as much credence that they did give women, they still had this prejudice against their integrity, reliability, and that kind of stuff. But don't blame me. I'm just the messenger.
Jack, addressing the women burying Jesus, I saw a video on Jewish burial practice, and I don't know if it's just the 20th century, but it was all women
that were
working on the body. So
okay. Great.
At least they're allowed to do that.
Could I squeeze in one more, Jack? I wasn't here when you started this series. Could you just make a moment's worth of comment? Who is Bart Ehrman, and why are you choosing to use his past reference for this presentation?
He's a professor of, I think, New Testament or something, religion, at a college in North Carolina. I'm not sure which one, University of North Carolina, somewhere. And he, having come from a Moody Bible Institute background as out of high school, eventually went to Princeton Seminary and basically changed his whole perspective on the scriptures, that it's not really the word of God. And then eventually the problem of evil, which we will deal with sometime here in the future, but the problem of the evil in the world actually turned him into an agnostic. He doesn't even, not even sure he believes that there's a God. But he has written several books that are bestsellers. That's why I'm choosing him, is because his books are bestsellers. All your friends and neighbors are reading them. Well, a couple of them are reading them. And the impression that they would get reading these books is, how can anyone in their right mind with any sort of honesty and integrity take the Bible to be the word of God? And I'm trying to argue that, well, some of us are not in our right mind, and we take the Bible to be the word of God.
I'm just wondering to what extent the writers of the Gospels read each other's stuff before they wrote their own account. I mean, would John have had access to, say, Luke?
It's unthinkable to me that he didn't. We know that Luke did, because he tells us at the opening of his Gospels, he says, many others have taken upon themselves to write an account of the things that happened among us. So, I mean, he's at least aware of the existence of other accounts, and it just seems highly likely that he has read them and is seeking to write something to supplement them. The source critics argue that some of them, their theory is that Mark was written first and Matthew literally had Mark in hand. It is uncanny how many verses you can find in Matthew that are literally word for word in Greek what Mark has. It's not a paraphrase, not his rendition, but literally word for word what you find in Mark. So I think that sounds right to me, that it's highly likely that Matthew is depending upon Mark.
So maybe John wouldn't fill in the blanks on the denials because it's his own eyewitness account and he's trying to be true to the fact that
exactly.
I'm not going to write anything that I didn't see.
Yeah, that's my theory, because if you were to map out what events and occasions and teachings do you find in the Synoptic Gospels, and the same thing with John, they overlap very, very little. There's just not a lot of overlap. Why? I think it's intentional on John's part. He's filling in the tradition. This is fine. What has already been written is fine. But he, as an eyewitness, directly knows some stuff that didn't make it into those accounts. And before he dies, he wants to get that in writing. I think that's his purpose, part of his purpose, one way of looking at his purpose. Okay, anything else? Well, rather than rush through the remainder of the material then, I'm going to just finish this next week, this outline. And so if you want to dig into the details, the guts of what I've given you in these handouts and stuff, and think about your questions and your problems, and if you want to bring them next week, I'll try to answer anything I can. Let me just comment. This is later in the notes, but let me just comment. I got an email this week that was a great question, and I want to respond to it. Do I care how many angels were at the empty tomb? Do I care how many times the rooster crowed? Not really. I'm not doing this because I care about having an inerrant and infallible record of those kinds of details, because nothing hinges on those kinds of details. Absolutely nothing hinges on them. So it's not that we need to have an authoritative source about those details. The issue is, notice Ehrman's argument. Ehrman's argument is, you put these accounts side by side, that you can't even reconcile them. What does that prove to him? What it proves to him is these are not the products of a single person and a single mind giving us a coherent, accurate, reliable account based on eyewitnesses. That's not what we have. What we have is, remember the story I told you in Form Criticism, what we have is a pearl necklace that has been patched together, strung together from traditions that have been shaped over the course of decades. They used to say centuries. They're back down to decades because archaeology's kind of proved them wrong. But over the course of decades, little by little by little, stories being made up, concocted, manufactured, fiction being told. And these fictional stories evolved over the course of time, and that's what we have. And then these pearls were strung together. Well, wouldn't you expect, when you take different pearls from different traditions, they're going to contradict each other and conflict with each other? So the conflicts and the contradictions and the tensions that you see in the text, that just proves that we are not dealing with an account that a single person like an apostle or a disciple or a fellow traveler with an apostle wrote out of his own research and out of his own, with his purpose, to give us an accurate and reliable account based on eyewitnesses. No way can we believe that that's what we've got. So the reason it's important to me to ask the question, are these accounts really that disparate from each other? Are they that much in tension with each other? Is because I do want to know whether we're dealing with true and reliable accounts about the resurrection and about Jesus' death. There are things that do matter to me. And the things that do matter to me, I want to know that I have a reliable account. I can assume that I have a reliable account because the apostle wrote it and he was there and he's trying to give me a reliable account. So when someone comes along and says, yeah, but you know, look at it. You're crazy to think that. You are a fanatical, Bible-believing, Bible-thumping nut if you believe that. I'm trying to argue, well, okay, I am a Bible-thumping nut, but not because I believe that. That there's a reason to believe that is completely rational. And that is that if we give the text a break, if we give it a chance and look at the little details, the little clues that we have, we can realize that, no, these really match up. These are completely compatible with each other. And compatible in a way that's not contrived. There's no conspiracy to get on the same page, to get your lies, you know, to tell the same lie. If there were, we wouldn't see the apparent tensions that we see. I mean, an obvious one. It's very subtle how Luke indicates the span of time that we're talking about. If you expect him to be saying Jesus died on Friday and Saturday was the Sabbath and he raised on Sunday, you can read that into Luke's account if you want to. But what you have to overlook is sometime between sundown on, I get it right, sundown on Friday and sundown on Friday, they bought spices and prepared all the things that they needed for Jesus' burial. There's like zero time for them to do that in. Well, and we could say, well, Luke, why didn't you tell us that there were two Sabbaths? Because he's writing to first century Jews who know that kind of thing. He doesn't have to tell them that. They know that stuff. But us ignorant 21st century Gentile Americans, I mean, that was news to me. I thought Sabbath was Saturday. and we read the account that way. And it's those kinds of assumptions that play into our expectations about how to put the pieces together. Well, they're not writing for us. And that's part of what we need to recognize is what we would expect them to do to make it clear to us, they're not going to do because they had never heard of America. And they had never thought that there'd be people as religiously ignorant as we are that would take the kind of expectations to the text that we do. So we have to take that into account as we deal with the accounts. Let's pray. Father, this is just truly an amazing story of what you did do and what you have accomplished. And Lord, we just pray that you would give us the confidence in the accounts that we have of that story so that we can delight in the full joy of everything that it is and everything that it means and everything that it signifies to us, because it won't be spoiled by our doubt and our fear that this is not true. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.